August 6, 2019 session of TeamSpeak for Tangerine SDR. My name is Dave, KV0S, and this week I've done a couple of things. One is I'm trying to develop some software architecture, and I have a couple questions later on about that. And the other one is after talking last week, I explored around. I've added a HamSci link on the Tangerine site as an icon. So if you click on the icon, it'll go over to the personal space weather web page. And there is a sub web page there called the working document page. And on that working document page is a number of things that Nathan has put there that are quite interesting documents, including a very nice synopsis by John Ackerman about the Allen variants. So we have some of those resources, and we just need to be sure that we are aware that those documents exist. So that's one thing. I also became aware that there were, I had put recordings up of the SDR Academy at Friedrichshafen, and it had a little cameo of Joe Taylor saying hello and answering a few questions. And then he ran off to be part of a contest presentation, contest forum. And I found the recordings of that contest forum and put those on our video link. So if you're interested in learning about changes to WSJTX, and there's an interesting discussion about how they decided to use GFSK and how that made a huge difference in their software. That's there. And because the guy who recorded it was sitting behind somebody, it's very hard to read the slides. So I actually found a recording on April 1st, all of this year. And the April 1st recording is pretty much identical slides to the one in Friedrichshafen. And they're much clearer. That's the Fairlawn ARC presentation. So all that is available on the website, and you're welcome to go see it. Next on the list, we have Dave, KD0EAG. Go ahead, Dave.
Hello, everyone. I've been plugging away lately at the magnetometer, trying to get some code operational. I'm getting there. We're at least speaking to each other at this point. Both a Arduino type driver and a Raspberry Pi little library specifically for interrogating the magnetometer and getting it to do whatever it will do and tell whatever secrets it knows. So that's pretty much been taking up my time the last few days, and progress is being made. Not all the way there. I'm going to try and get it done by the end of the week, because I'll be going off on other adventures for a week or two with family before I'll get back to it.
Well, fine business, Dave, and good luck with that. Next on the list, we have G. Perry, KD2SAK, and he, go ahead.
Hi there, everybody. I'm just checking in from the, I guess, the professional science aspect to checking in. I haven't been on for a few weeks, but we're all kind of rotating through, and tonight's my night, so I'll leave it at that and let you get on with it.
Well, fine business. And next on the list, we have Mike AAK, shown as recording in a way, and we thank Mike for posting the TeamSpeak sessions to the tsarchive.tangerinesdr.org, and so you can find them in a link on the TeamSpeak session. So if you miss a TeamSpeak session, you can just go and listen to it in the recording. Next on the list is Rick, W2GPS. Go ahead, Rick.
Thank you. Good evening. I've been talking with John Ackerman, or I should say emailing, regards some tests that we might make on the steered oscillator, GPS steered oscillator, using the M8F GPS module, hoping to be able to produce a variety of results depending upon the quality and architecture of the oscillator relative to the GPS module. So mostly we've been doing talking, not so much doing yet. I have the stuff here running to be tested, but he has the test equipment. You know how that goes. John, one thing that we also talked about is the migration ultimately to the Super GPS, the M9 module, which covers dual frequencies. I'll, for simplicity, just call them L1, L2. And that is really exciting if we can get a good timing module from a 9 series receiver, because they dynamically correct for ionospheric errors. And that's a very good thing if you're trying to get accuracy to UTC instead of just relative accuracy between stations that are fairly close together. if you want stations far apart, you need that capability. John was unaware of any timing version of that receiver being available. As of today, I was informed that that my commercial team will be receiving its first timing version of that receiver any day now. It has been shipped, so I'll have to let John know that they in fact do exist. But downside is we are still unaware of any version of that that steers oscillators, which could put us back to the old-fashioned techniques for steering oscillators, and that's not a place we want to go with the budget we have. So we've got a lot of work to do and a number of avenues to pursue. Over.
Well, fine business, Rick. And next on the list, we have Tom. N5EG. Go ahead, Tom.
Oh, good evening, Dave. Good evening to everyone. It's been a busy week. Let's see. I've reformatted and renamed 6 specifications and updated what's on the Tangerine SDR website. Those incorporate Scotty's part numbers and format templates and things, and found some interesting things about Word that I didn't know about before. Secondly, I wrote a interface control document for the magnetometer and put the first draft of that up on the Tangerine SDR site, and that's open for comments. That one is pretty far along because we know most of the connectors and the parts used on it. So I think we could go into design and prototyping of that fairly soon. I'd like to see what Dave Witten has first in terms of his test results, and if he's had the chance to check out the differential I2C extenders that he mentioned in a previous TeamSpeak session. Thirdly, I've started working on the RF module interface control document, and we need to have some discussion about that tonight. There's a couple of different ways to try to handle that document. If we try to have it cover all 6 RF modules, my fear is it may get a little bit ugly. In going through the work, I found that we seem to need more I/O pins than exist on the M.2 connector in certain circumstances. I think there's ways we could make it fit on an M.2, but they're not pretty. And then lastly, I'd like to ask a question. If we know enough information to assign M.2 pins for the clock module, my feeling is we have now quite a bit of information on the requirements and the connectors. We may or may not be ready to do any kind of prototyping yet, and Rick will have to advise us on what direction we ought to go there. So that's about it for the week.
Well, fine business, Tom. And next on the list is Scotty, WA2DFI. Go ahead, Scotty.
Okay, thanks, Dave, and good afternoon, evening, everyone. I guess it's pretty much evening everywhere. Anyway, this week I finally got around to reviewing and commenting on Tom's RF module spec. And sorry, Tom, I didn't get that to you. I drew everything up, and then I went home Friday, and I didn't send it out to him until this morning. So it's yet again, here's right before TeamSpeak, here's your update to comment on. So we can talk a little bit about that, Tom, if you want. And as far as the connector goes, I think after thinking about this most of the day and poking around, I think, Tom, I've come to the conclusion that I really don't want to try and shoehorn it onto 68 pins for the RF connectors. And we can kind of move things around and use an MEC-type connector, which is a little bit more expensive. But if we put the connector on the RF module, then we don't actually incur the cost on the DE, so we can still keep the DE inexpensive, although we'll move the cost to the RF module, but you'll only have one if you buy one RF module, so that might be something that is feasible. And it gives us a lot more pins and a lot more flexibility. So I think that's something we ought to talk about here and see if we can figure out the best way to do it. And see what else. I guess trying to get a connector pinned on the clock module. I don't know enough about that to know if we have enough pins. I think we have enough pins. I think we just have to define what they are and where they are, and at least give it a stab. And then we'll have to, get Rick and John and Tom together and beat on the thing and figure out if we have enough pins to do everything that we want, especially in light of the fact that we might want to be able to use the new oscillator steering module, the M9, I think it's a number, if it's going to become available. So I guess I'm presuming that the M8F and the M9F are going to have similar IO pins or similar steering characteristics. Maybe that's not a valid assumption, but at any rate, so as far as the documents go, Tom, I think that my intent for the ICDs, the interface control document, should be a document that we can throw out there and let people design boards to. So it should be a single document that defines the interface. And then I'm kind of after talking to you or reading your emails and thinking about it, I'm really kind of leaning toward, well, the actual pin function should be in the spec for the device, the particular RF module that we're building, or one of the six we're building, and it just needs to be compatible with the ICD, the interface itself, so it can plug in. Because the problem is that the interface is programmable. It goes to an FPGA, and all of the pins virtually, except for obviously power pins and dedicated clock pins, those aren't programmable. But the other ones are all programmable. So you really don't have to specify them in the hardware, but you have to specify them in the FPGA program dependent upon the board you plug in. So I don't know if you got my email that I sent out late this afternoon, but I kind of explained how I thought it should work. And if you had time to look at that, we might talk about it. So that's about all I got for this week. So back over to you, Dave. Thanks.
Fine business. And next on the list, we have Bill, AB4EGA. And go ahead, Bill.
Thanks, Dave, and good evening to the net. Well, just a couple things this week. I finalized the wording for some of the publicity material that's going to the Huntsville Hamfest. I am giving a talk in one of the forums that's going to deal with the personal space weather station. And Huntsville is a good place for this because we have a lot of people who are going to be very interested in this project, and we may be able to drum up some additional volunteer. I'm mainly concerned with the software development. So anyway, that's going to be in a couple of weeks. Second of all, I started doing more work on the architecture for the central control system. My idea is to use or take a lot of design tips from the Satnogs project. They use a system called Django, D-J-A-N-G-O, Django, which is a web development system that runs under Linux. And when I started digging into their system a little bit further, I realized, you know, I don't think I know this thing well enough to be able to develop in it yet. So I spent most of this last week going through a tutorial on Django to bring myself up to speed on it. I got about halfway through it. So I'm going to continue doing that until I know Django well enough to be pretty dangerous. I mean, you can get on there and play around with Django and use pre-made stuff, but if you want to make a full-blown website with all of the features, internationalization, and a back-end database and everything, you have to know it. So that's what I'm doing now, is coming up to speed. And but so far, everything I've looked at so far suggests very strongly this is going to be an ideal platform on which to base the central control system. With a back-end database of MariaDB, which is the open source version of MySQL. Anyway, that's what I've been working on this week. Back to Ned.
Well, fine business, Bill. And next on the list, we have Dan in for XWE. Go ahead, Dan.
Okay, thank you, Dave. Well, this week I actually tried to make myself a little bit more knowledgeable on magneto-inductive magnetometers and took a long look at the PNI webpage, which didn't have a tremendous amount of information on it. I'm assuming we're going the direction of the RM3100 for the magnetometer, or at least something similar. There are a couple of YouTube videos out there that explain it. There are also three or four papers from various sources that do a fairly good job of explaining the technology, although they aren't really part number specific. Anyway, that's about it from here. Back to you, Dave.
Well, fine business, Dan. And that brings us to the end of the list, so we're open for general discussion.
Yeah, before we jump into general discussion, I just want to profusely thank Tom for doing all that work and on those documents and figuring out the header and footer stuff. That was a ton of thankless task work, Tom.
Well, thanks. It's nice to have it in the rearview mirror. And I appreciate your putting out the templates and getting all the part numbers together. That that table made it a lot easier to work on the documents.
By the way, which reminds Tom, this is Bill. Thanks for sending along that C module on the Allen deviation. I haven't had a chance to work with it yet, but believe me, I certainly will. I took a look at the data, and it does look like it is definitely amenable to analysis with the program you sent. Thanks.
Okay, very good. Yeah, that was something that Tom Van Bock wrote, around the year 2000 or so. So it's just plain old C code, and it's been beaten up pretty good. So it's a fairly trustworthy piece of software.
Yeah, you can hardly beat C.
So Tom, you want to talk about how we're going to split the documents up a bit?
Yeah. The concern I have, I'm trying to figure out how to write an ICD, the interface control document, that covers six modules. And I came up with two possible approaches, both of which have drawbacks. And we may need to discuss the right way to do that. One approach is to go into the requirements, and for every requirement in the requirements document, have six answers. For the dual receiver, the answer is A. For the single receiver, the answer is B. For the transmitter, it's none of the above, that kind of a thing. And that makes the requirements document pretty lengthy. And if you just have an interest in one of those modules, you have to skip five out of every six paragraphs to figure out just the module you're interested in. So the other approach is basically to put six requirements documents under a single cover and, basically repeat the boilerplate and have each chapters 1 to 10 be the dual receiver module, chapters 11 to 20 be the same thing except for the single channel. So that's a different approach. When I looked at the ICD, the connector pinout table is humongous in the ICD I'm working on. It's 11 pages. And if we have to make that cover six modules instead of one, I'm afraid we're going to have a 66-page ICD for the RF modules.
Yeah, and I said, because it's a little difficult because we really have, like you said, we have different requirements for each module, but then I'm getting a little confused between modules that we're going to build on the one hand and target uses for those modules on the other hand. So the target usage has requirements, but the modules that we build have specifications. So it's not clear how we want to, whether we want to put all that into the requirements document and into one requirements document. I think you're exactly right. It's going to get so unwieldy that it's going to be a real problem. And then what's going to happen is you're going to edit the document, come out with a new version, and it might only change board number 3. And if you're using board number 2, then you're kind of wondering, well, what changed in my section? Well, nothing. So maybe they ought to be separate documents. And as far as the ICD goes, like I said, my view is that the ICD should define the interface. So the ICD for the RF module should not have anything in it on connectors that are on individual RF modules, like filter pinouts or anything like that, because that's really in the specification for that board. What it needs to have is the interface to the other boards in the system. So it's kind of strange, I guess, because you're going to have a filter module that plugs onto the RF module, and there's an interface there, so you could define that. But I'm thinking that really, I'm not sure how to do that exactly. The ICD should define things for people who want to build stuff that's going to plug into things that we're going to build, to extend this project out to future frontiers, shall we say.
Yeah, understand. Let me give an example. The dual receiver has got channel 0, 14-bit bus, go in the RF module to the DE, and channel 1 receiver, 14-bit bus, going from the RF module to the DE. The transceiver module has a 14-bit bus outbound and a 14 bus inbound because it's feeding a transmitter. And then there's control lines for that transmitter that aren't used on the receiver. And, so there's a whole lot of differences in the pin functionality between a transceiver module and a dual receiver module.
Right. So the idea would be that you've got to design each of the modules to plug into the standard configuration socket on the data engine, which will maybe have several different data engines, but they should have the same type socket on them. And those pins are programmable on the DE. And so my thought was, you're going to have a couple dedicated pins. You're going to have a clock supplied by the oscillator, and you're going to have a clock supplied by the FPGA, and you're going to have power and ground. And then you're going to have a serial, like an I2C channel, just a clock and data is all it's going to be, a point-to-point channel back to the FPGA. And we're going to put a small PROM on each board that defines what this board is. Rather than take a bunch of parallel pins and say, this combination is a dual channel and this combination is a transceiver, just put a 30-cent serial PROM on the board that the FPGA can read and say, oh, I see, you're a dual channel board. I'm going to configure my I/O pins this way, and then it can talk to the whatever board is plugged in. And in the document that I sent you, the email I sent you, I was defining 3 16-bit wide LVDS ports, two inbound to the DE and one outbound from the DE. And that's 32 pins plus associated grounds. So those are programmable, however. So if the RF module happens to be designed as a single-ended 16-bit output to the DE, the ADC is single-ended, then you just take half of those LVDS pins and use them as inputs, and they become single-ended. If it's a 16-bit LVDS port, or 14 bits in this case, you use 14 of the 16. So by having 3 ports, you get 2 inbound and 1 outbound. So you could really have a dual channel receiver with a single channel transmitter, and that would all theoretically fit in the same connector. Whether we could fit it all on the board or not is another question, but they would at least fit on the same connector. And then I left, and this may not be sufficient, but I left 8 pins left over for GPIO, general purpose, another I2C port, LEDs, signaling, status pins, control pins, whatever you wanted to do for that particular module. So the hard part would be defining this as more of a general, here's the 3 buses that we have, and they can be defined, each of them can be defined this way or that way or the other way, and then that becomes the ICD.
Okay, well, I agree with that if we're talking about the ICD for the data engine. I have difficulty with that if we're talking about the ICD for a particular module. For example, the dual RF module, the buses coming out of it aren't FPGA driven. They're driven by an ASIC, which is hardwired in how it drives the pins. And so the ICD for the RF module has to say, data bit zero for channel zero is an output from the RF module, and it has to show up on these pins. And so the ICD has to nail down all of that stuff because the RF module itself is hardwired. You go over to the data engine side, and you can say, we can make this an input or we can make it an output. So does that clarify?
Yeah. So basically you have a standard interface on the data engine that's programmable. And then on each particular RF module, you're going to assign those programmable programmable pins to either in or out or LVDS or CMOS 3 volts or whatever it is that the part on the RF module has to supply because it's not programmable. So then how do we specify this? Should there be an ICD for each plug-in module that marries up with the ICD of the data engine? Because my thought is, normally you would say on a plug-in module for a PC, well, I have an ISA bus module. So I define the ISA bus, and now any card that wants to plug in has to be compatible with the ISA bus. But of course, the ISA bus isn't a programmable direction and function bus like ours is. So it does get pretty gnarly in how you want to do it. So it almost seems like you need, classes of ICDs, and then here's the generic, how it's going to work for everyone, and then here's specific A, specific B, specific C boards that are going to plug into that. And the idea is then somebody can come along and say, take the ICD for the interface on the DE and say, I'm going to design board D, and it's going to be different than any of your boards, but it's still going to plug into that same connector and interface to that bus.
I agree with that. And so where you would get that information is the ICD for the data engine would define the connector M.2 or MEG or whatever connector we use, and all of the classes and all of the input, output, programmable, bidirectional, voltage level, all of that stuff. And then each individual RF module would have an ICD or a subset of an ICD that would say how that module plans to implement what it's going to do on its side of that same connector.
Okay, so then when you do that, and you have an ICD basically for each module, I'm kind of wondering, so what do you do for the other connectors on the board, like the filter connectors or any external connectors to define the pinouts? Would that be part of that the RF board's ICD, or would that be part of the RF board specification when you build the board?
In my view, it would be part of the ICD for the RF board, because the plug-on filter plugs onto a connector that's on the RF board. That connector goes between the RF board and the plug-on filter board, and I would assume we would use those plug-on filter boards on multiple different kinds of RF boards.
Okay, so that makes sense to have each board have its own requirements document, ICD, and eventually specification if we get that far to want to do that. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I think that was the way I was, kind of rummaging it around in my head. I suspect other folks have done this before and vice versa.
You have something, Dave?
Yes, I had a question. There seems to be a bottleneck here in that we can find programmers that have a variety of background, but I don't know very many FPGA programmers that are jumping into the project. And I know you have some capability, but you also have a big role in designing layouts of boards. So are we going to be able to find somebody to help you do all this configurable FPGA code?
Well, I hope so, because at Hamcation, I got the name of a gentleman who was a ham who was interested in FPGAs, and he seemed to be interested enough to go off and buy a Max 10 development kit and start getting up to speed. He was mostly a Xilinx guy, but he was willing to work on the Max 10 since that's the first one we're going to build. and who knows what we'll build after that. But the point was that he was a Verilog guy. So, I mean, Verilog is Verilog. If you're interested in helping, then we got a place for you to help. So that I haven't talked to him in a while, but there's one other one. And then I think you were telling me about another FPGA guy that we might be able to cajole into helping us. And I think we have some people even on here who would be interested in doing that.
I did know one guy, but his deal was his day job. He had few jobs for a while, and then all of a sudden he had like three jobs in all at once.
Yeah, isn't that the problem that we all have?
Yep, but this guy had a good background with Red Pataya, and he had written several other pieces of code that, so he had a good familiarity with how the RF chain works.
Yeah, and so the important thing is to make sure that we get this documented so that we can make it easy to interface to these boards, even though, you know, it's not going to help in the functions that we're going to implement, but you got to get the I/O connected up right in the right direction before you can go anywhere.
Yes, I understand. I just wanted to make sure, put in the word for the FPGA programming, because otherwise we've got a bunch of modules that have to be connected to a whole bunch of different kind of interfaces, and it makes the upper level programming a little bit harder.
Yeah, well, my problem's never been thinking too small, so this it's going to be a long time before we have all these modules that we have to interface to. So maybe I think, Tom, we got the best idea, or you had the best idea, is make them separate, and then we could focus on the one that we're building, and we don't have to get distracted by trying to fit six specifications into one.
Yeah, I think in the specification can call out the RF module and what it does, and that's the opportunity to say, you know, well, the dual one is for the personal space weather station, and it's got noise sources, two channels, and the different spec for the low-cost single channel says, no, it doesn't need noise sources, and it's only one channel. And I was thinking that it would just be easier to have a single spec per RF module and a single ICD per RF module, and then we could go 100 miles an hour on the first one, and then when we get that working, then we can go work on the other ones.
Yeah, and the idea would be, I think, is to not really say that the dual channel one is targeted at the space weather station, although I guess you could mention that. The idea would be you'd have module type 1, 2, 3, 4, and then in the personal space weather station requirements, you could say the requirements are fulfilled by Tangerine SDR module type 1 and DE type 1 and the clock module type 3, and that's what we need to build the station.
Yeah, that's a good approach. I don't have to mention PSWS in the requirements documents, but they do need to be spelled out. We do need to spell out the jitter. We need to spell out the clock accuracy. We need to spell out the noise source. And we don't have to mention that those are called out because the PSWS, we think, needs those capabilities. But you know, but that RF module definitely needs those capabilities if we're going to call out using that.
Go ahead, Dave.
Well, I just wanted to back up what Dave KVOS said, in that I do think that the FPGA programming effort here is something we should regard as an area of risk to the project, because the rumors I hear is that RF grade FPGA programmers are much scarcer even than usual right now. And unless we have identified skills available to us, we better be careful what we assume that will wander along.
Yeah, and my hope is that you know, since we're starting out with one board at the beginning, if we write the FPGA code to interface basically that one board to the LCC, local command and control protocol, then really there's not much that's going to change in the FPGA for that board. So it's not going to be like the software end where you're going to be writing new apps and you're going to be processing the data differently. I mean, if we get the if if we feed the IQ data to the host processor, then he's going to do what he's going to do with that, and that's much easier to modify because there's many more software people out there than there are FPGA programmers. So, but you're right, we do need FPGA support for each variant that we build.
Well, the scuttlebutt I've heard is that the latest RF development has just eaten the latest telecom developments are eating up the high-end RF guys like crazy, and they're just can't get them.
So we need to find some retired guys who have nothing to do.
Yeah, well,
I know, good luck with that, right? All the retired guys are now contractors taking on extra work.
Most people who are retired, they're busier than they were when they were working.
There is truth to that.
But don't we get to do more fun stuff?
Well, absolutely, yes.
You bet. Well, that's a good reason for going to the wider connector, Scotty. I could solve the problems with the pin count on the M.2, but it required using DDR data interfaces, which gets the bit rates on the I.O. pins of the FPGA up to 250 megabits a second.
Yeah, and 250 meg is just about at the limit, maybe even past the limit a little bit of the max 10. So, you can use higher performance FPGAs, which will easily handle that. But this is a low cost one. So that would be less desirable to do that. And by the way, that connector that I sent you, that MEC, I finally decoded the part number. So they have a 1 millimeter pitch, a 2 millimeter pitch, a 0.8 millimeter pitch, and a 0.5 millimeter pitch. The one I picked, of course, was the 0.5 because it's the smallest one. It's a little more expensive, but it's rated to 56 gigabits per second on the pins.
Yeah, I was looking through return loss S21 performance on the M.2 and found some of the tests that they have. We wouldn't have to go nearly as fast as what a lot of folks are using M.2 for, because they're using it for PCIe that's running at 8 giga transfers per second. Their issue there is a crosstalk between the pins. Scotty, if you can send me a link to the MEC connector, which includes drawings and pinouts and things like that, that'll really help me revise the ICD that I'm working on.
I can certainly do that. In fact, it's a Samtec connector, and they have all the RF characterization and 3D models and just about everything you need. So just a second. I got it on the screen here. I'll post it down on the bottom.
Great. That would help. In looking through the tests for the M.2, I found that you have to pair the differential signals in an M.2 odd to odd for plus and minus, and then another signal can be even to even, but you can't split a differential signal between an even numbered pin and an odd numbered pin on an M.2.
It's the same on the MEC5, because the odd pins are on one side and the evens are on the other. And since when the board plugs in, the odds and the evens will be on opposite sides of the board. So you really want to have the pairs on the same side of the board so you can run them as differential lines.
Yeah, I'll look at that MEC and count pins and count buses. One thing that they did in PCIe on the M.2 was they put a ground in between every single differential pair. And, that eats up, another 30 or so or 40 pins on the connector. I don't think we're going to need that. The PCIe, the lanes run asynchronously, and they run up at 4 or 8 gigatransfers a second. And so you have differential pairs that are next to each other that are running at different transfer rates, slightly, asynchronous to one. And so crosstalk's a concern because of the high rate. I think we're planning to use a synchronous bus, and so the bus will have a chance to settle down before being clocked in. So I'm hoping we won't have to chew up quite so many ground pins.
Well, the pin assignment, it was not really an assignment, but it's just kind of a pin summary. They make, in our range of connectors, they make 100, 120, 140, and 160. 7.3 there, Dave. they make those different size connectors in dual row. So I'm thinking the 140 would fit. And so what we do is we would take 20 pins and we'd use them for power and FPGA clock, oscillator clock, and control I2C, and eight extra pins for whatever you like, which leaves 120 pins split into three 16-bit buses. Now, so that's 40 pins a piece times three is 120. So each one of the 40-pin buses is actually 16 differential pairs, that's 32, and then eight ground lines. So you end up with ground, pair, pair, ground, pair, pair. So every four lines, you have a ground. So that means every twisted, every matched pair has a ground on one side of it. And I think, do you think that will be sufficient?
Yeah, I need to look at this in some detail. I don't think I can figure this out on a TeamSpeak session. When I, you know, did the first cut at the ICD, I ended up with 56 signal pins, and and I only had like four grounds, but I ended up with about 45 or 48 other pins that weren't related to the buses that had to do with power, clocks, the encoder clocks, the loopback return clocks, and others. And so, you know, I'm worried about not having enough spare pins, and so I need to really dig into it.
Yeah, yeah, and mine was just a very cursory, I didn't take that into account. In fact, it did occur to me right after I sent it that I didn't provide for the return clock, but the FPGA has dedicated clock inputs, but the clock outputs can come from any pin. So it's the clock inputs that have to be, so like for instance, the 2208 clock out would have to go in on a clock in pin on the interface. So the only other thing to keep in mind is we can go up to 160 pins, but the 160 pin connector is wider than 50 millimeters. So if we make the board, and I told you I was thinking of expanding the board to 100 millimeters wide, well, we can put two 140s side by side on 100 millimeters, but you can't put two 160s side by side. So if we did need the 160, which I'm not ruling out, I mean, it's going to depend on what we come up with. We may have to make the board a little bit wider.
Okay, well, before we go off and try to design it, let me continue working on the very first receiver module ICD, and let's get that cranked out, and then we can review it. I've tried to account for all the pins I know about, and that's where I came up with 40 something pins outside of everything else, and that doesn't include pins for signature EEPROMs or anything like that. But let me put that together, and then we'll have a chart and a table that we can discuss.
Okay, and we can work on that this weekend by email, because what I can do is work on the RF connector ICD for the data engine at the same time. We can get them kind of married together so that they will work.
Okay, I think that's a wise thing to do. It's surprising how many little things you find when you start trying to identify every single pin and what it does.
Yeah, because see, my first thought was, okay, a dual channel receiver that needs two input channels, but there's no transmitter, so you don't need an output channel. So those extra 16 bits can be assigned to anything you like. And if they're control lines and they're single-ended, then you get 32 bits. And if you want to do a transceiver board, you're likely to have only one receive channel and one transmit channel. So you still have 16-bit bus, the differential bus left over to pirate pins out of. So you could still make it work in those two cases. And if you're looking at like Lime Micro or 9361, sorry, ADI part, the ADI part uses two 12-bit buses. They're 6-bit differential, so it's 12 bits. So those fit into the 16-bit buses we have, and then the third bus is available for whatever else you need to program it to. So it 120 pins might just be enough.
Okay, well, we'll take a look. I figured on the buses, the the receiver could be two output buses and the transceiver could be an output bus and a bus. But again, it'll all come down to how many miscellaneous things there are and the count. We'll do that. On a different subject, Dave Witten, have you had a chance to look at the I2C range extenders that you acquired for the magnetometer?
I haven't quite got to that. I have them, and I'm working today with just getting an exercise or routine for talking to the thing. And then my next step was to feed it across a length of Cat5 with those range extenders.
Okay, very good. I tried to describe how I thought they might be used in the pinout in the ICD for the magnetometer, which is up on the Tangerine site. And it looks at which pin numbers in the Ethernet cable might be assigned to which functions in the range extender. Have you had a chance to look at that?
I really haven't, but I can do that. I really didn't want to do that until I got my fingers properly dirty with the sensor itself. Lots of little odds and ends they haven't documented and that I've had to figure out. I know it's not very fancy compared to some of the other stuff, but I want to do it right.
Yeah. I can understand that. If the modules don't talk, it's kind of hard to figure out if the range extender is working.
Yeah, I've had to make my own little interface and find that some of the signals absolutely have to be tied where there's no mention of it in any of the documentation, but like the addresses, if they float, you get all kinds of, they seem to move around and all kinds of little stuff. So I'm getting there, did a lot today, and I should have something to report before the end of the week on almost all of it.
Okay, very good. Yeah, I went ahead and in the ICD tied the address bits down to zero figure, and we'd never have more than one magnetometer on it, a single system. Maybe that's not a good assumption. At any rate, I looked at that. The other thing is I tried to match up the pairs in the Ethernet cable with the clock and the data signals for I2C so that we didn't go through any pair split.
Very good. I'll look closely at anything you've put up there, be sure. And I'll definitely be in touch with anything pertinent I find.
Oh, excellent! Having a real world test with those extenders just makes the documentation is more likely to be correct from the get go.
Yeah, they're simple little things. Even the sensor is not very, it's not expensive. If anyone else feels an urge to purchase one, there's two versions, and one is, I think, $20, and one is like $61, and the only difference is they've soldered the pins in for you, just standard 10th-inch spacing pins. It's really silly, but, some marketing guys, I guess.
Yeah, that is kind of silly. At any rate, I was surprised at how easily the documents came together. It's having good base documentation for all the parts makes assembling the specs a lot easier.
I'm sure good documentation will make all this effort on everybody's part much more worthwhile and useful to other people in the future.
Yeah, we have to be careful not to talk about it too much. It may not be the most exciting team speak.
Oh, but it's important.
Yeah, like editing 7 documents, right, Tom?
I'm willing to do that if it avoids a single 100-page document.
Yeah, I think that is something definitely to be avoided.
Yeah, I figured I would be readily capable of producing write-only documentation, which means the author understands it. Nobody else can possibly understand it.
Oh, there's too many documents like that out there already.
Seems like the simplest micro anymore is 2,000 to 5,000 pages minimum.
Yeah, if we can avoid that, I think a lot of people will be thankful.
Well, wasn't it the TS-950, the Kenwood SDR? Wasn't the user's manual like 270 pages?
Wouldn't be surprised.
And then I think I brought that up at one of the talks at Hamvention, and somebody said, oh, but that's not, that doesn't count because it's mostly just screenshots.
And then, and 30 pages of warnings before you turn it on.
Yeah, really. I we bought a new car years ago. It was a VW Jetta, and they actually put all the warnings in a separate booklet and included that in the package, so you didn't have all your reading interrupted. But it's kind of useless to move all the warnings off into a separate book. So if you're really bored some night, you can read through the warnings booklet.
Or you can maybe indicate how fearless you are and how macho you are by just throwing away the warnings booklet.
Hey, we're engineers. We don't read books anyway, do we? We build stuff.
That's the whole idea.
I remember when I was learning sailing, or trying to learn sailing, because my dad had a sailboat. We were going to go out. And so I thought, well, I'll get some books and I'll read up. And finally, he got really tired of answering all my questions. And he says, well, real sailors don't read books. They just go out and sail.
Oh, yeah, that's one of those things that's best learned by doing it.
Helps if you don't live in a landlocked place like Arizona, though.
Yeah, where would you go sailing in Arizona? I don't guess you could yet.
Oh, yeah, there's Lake Mead, Lake Powell, they used to be a lot better when there was water in them.
Yeah, there you go.
They're pretty low. In fact, it's amazing. If you go up to Lake Mead and look at the, you can see where the old water levels were and all the coves and inlets. And it is amazing how far the water levels dropped just in the past 20 years.
Is it up 4 stories from where you are on your boat?
Yes, it is. And a lot of the coves you can't even get into anymore because they're dry.
Well, can you just walk into them then?
Yes, you can.
Yeah, bring your kayak and your bicycle.
That's right. Exactly right. Or your waders.
All right. Are we done here?
I think so. Anyone have anything else? The silence is deafening. Oh, did you have something, Tom?
No, I was just going to say idle here.
I did have one comment one minor request. I know that a lot of people, there's a lot of small matters that people are exchanging some information with each other via email, person to person, and that's great. But if it's anything that might possibly be of general interest to any of the rest of us, it would be kind of nice if it would go through the list, just so, I like to have a sense of what people are talking about sometimes, but it doesn't matter too much.
Well, I definitely agree. Sometimes, though, it's more expeditious to have a few back and forths one-on-one and then come up with a plan before we propose it. So that's kind of the only reason I keep it off the list. But yeah, you're right. It's sometimes it's good to see the thought process.
Yeah, I have to admit, though, I've been having some challenges in keeping up with all of the discussion. It's just so much that's coming by. But I don't mean to discourage us from letting it, fly. It's just that don't expect everybody to be able to read everything.
Yeah, so we kind of break off into subgroups and work on certain more specific things, then bring it back to the group. Is that what you mean, Bill?
Oh, maybe so. I mean, there's a. I'm just saying that the amount of the number of interesting topics, it takes 10 minutes to read and digest every email, and there's 20 of them. So it's restrains my ability to keep up with it sometimes.
Okay, well, I appreciate the work everyone's done. It's progressing along pretty well. I'm hoping maybe in the next couple of weeks we can kind of plan for what we're going to show off at DCC this year, and maybe I don't know if there's any other goals after that. Hamvention next year, or whatever we're planning to show to talk it up. I like Bill's idea of talking about it to the local club there, especially the Huntsville Club. And I know in August I'm going to make a presentation on Tangerine to the local club here in West Phoenix. So maybe get some, I don't know if we'll get really any new recruits for help, but we might get some interested parties to want hardware and talk to us about features.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's what I'm thinking. The more we can talk this up, I mean, we should try and identify as many big ham fests as possible where we can make a special point of it to go there and try and get on get in one of the forums to talk about this project, because we really are going to need people to step up and say, hey, this is interesting to me. I want to buy one of those systems and participate.
Yeah, and you know, what do you think about this idea of maybe making some videos that aren't at a hamvention or aren't at the conference, just to say, hey, let's sit down and talk about this and then post them?
You know, that's a really good idea. I wonder if we could get some help from Ham Nation or one of those semi-commercial groups to help us with doing that.
Yeah, I know Dave has a lot of experience with recording too. And the thing is that even if we were to record the content, it still needs editing, right? So you need someone experienced and able to do that to make it look nice.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, well, food for thought. And thanks, everyone, for coming. And I guess we're done unless anyone has any last-minute things.
No. Scotty, thanks for all the work you're doing on the connectors and finding all this stuff. It's really helping things move along.
Oh, no problem. I think you're carrying the lion's share here, and I appreciate the all that editing and all that formatting, and basically even just the framework there lights the fire under me to get working on it. So that's good. Thanks.